right, the next case we're going to hear this morning is W.C. English, Inc. versus Rommel, Klepper & Call. And Mr. Paul, whenever you're ready, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, I'm Dustin Paul here on behalf of W.C. English, and at the table with me is my law partner, Jim Harvey. We're here because the trial court erroneously entered summary judgment in favor of both defendants in this case. We believe that judgment was incorrect, but the reasons the judgment was incorrect differ between the two defendants. Regarding the first defendant, which we'll refer to as R.K. and K., the trial court entered an erroneous summary judgment decision because it misinterpreted the party's contract, specifically part of the indemnification provision between W.C. English and RK&K. The court, contrary to a wealth of authority and the basic meaning of the terms within the indemnification clause, found that it created some sort of contributory negligence scheme, rather than, as eight other state courts have found, it creates, by using the word extent, a comparative negligence scheme. With regard to the other defendant, CDM Smith, it's more of a classic summary judgment problem. The trial court failed to give all disputed facts in favor of W.C. English and failed to give all reasonable inferences in favor of W.C. English instead. On appeal, of course, both of those issues are considered de novo, and with the court's permission, I'd like to address the RKK issue first and talk about the contractual language.
So do you concede that your client was negligent?
For purposes of this appeal, I don't think there's any value for us to examine that issue. We may certainly argue before a jury that we had no negligence or our negligence was inconsequential.
You know, the negligence, you guys discuss negligence, and the contracts have provisions talking about negligence on the one hand and failure to perform on the other. But in many cases that we have had over the period of years I've been here, we have rejected the notion that we adopt a negligence standard when we're talking about the performance of a contract. If a subcontractor backs his bulldozer over a fellow contractor, there's a negligence issue. But if somebody fails to conform to a spec, that's not a negligence issue, it's a contract issue. Now, the contract does distinguish in this case, and I wouldn't even call it a contributory negligence or a comparative negligence. It's you can use that as a metaphor, but it seems to me the right approach in this case, it's all non-performance. There's no negligence issue about some duty independent of the contract.
I think that's correct. There's some confusion here because
there's a lot of confusion.
At least one of the provisions uses the word negligence as to one of the parties. But fundamentally here, what we're talking about is performance or non-performance under the contract. And here, it's clear that what the parties adopted was a comparative scheme in which their respective faults would be allocated, and they'd have to pay to replace any work that the VOT found non-compliant according to how much fault each of the parties had. And we get to that by the basic language of the indemnification provision, which provides that the indemnification obligation exists to the extent of the negligence or the fault of RK&K, but not to the extent of the fault of W.C. English.
So the district court thought, maybe so if you just look at that one provision, but that if you look at the three things that RK&K marked up, it seems clear that on the other two, there's no comparative inquiry being required. And so why would this one have been different? Like, what's the reasoning for why the parties would have agreed we want something more like contributory negligence under the first paragraph and the damages provision, but on this one in particular, this one we want something more comparative?
I think the answer to that, and we try to address this in the brief by talking about the Virginia Supreme Court cases, the answer to that is there's a difference in the basic insurance structure that's behind these two types of losses. With regard to personal property damage, regard to personal injuries, regard to wrongful death, those are the type of claims that are handled under a comprehensive general liability policy. Those are things that every contractor and subcontractor has insurance in place for, So when you allocate those risks under an indemnification provision, what you're really allocating is who's going to pay those particular insurance premiums and whose insurance is going to have to step up and defend a claim that somebody was injured at the job site and which insurance company is ultimately going to have to pay that liability. It's a different situation when you address, as this does in paragraph 2 of section 11, what is a contractual performance issue. With some exceptions, very few parties actually carry insurance on that. What you're usually allocating there is who is going to take the hit to the company's actual bottom line. Who's going to have to pay out of pocket? Who's going to have to pay that year's profits towards, in this case, rebuilding a bridge on I-81? And it's completely reasonable that the parties would look at that and say, well, we're willing to put in our portion of redoing that work. For whatever degree of fault or negligence was on us, we will pay that. But what we're not doing is going to identify you for 100% if we were only 3% responsible. And I think because of that, it makes sense that the parties would adopt different schemes to deal with that. And contrary to the district court, I think the fact that the parties use different words here, use different contractual clauses, is actually an indication that they wanted to treat these issues differently. If they wanted personal injuries to be treated like insufficiency of contract performance, all you'd have to do is take that language from the first part of paragraph of section 11 and just move it down to the second part of section 11. But that's not what the parties did. In fact, according to the record, as we cite in the brief, what happened was they went in and actually interlineated the indemnification provision to add in the structure that talks about to the extent of one party's negligence, but not to the extent of the other party's fault. And what this is reflective of is eight of the cases that we cite to the court in which courts have looked at similar provisions before and said, when you use the word extent, you're trying to measure. You're trying to tell the size of something. You're trying, in this provision, to compare something, which is the relative fault of the two parties. So I think here, yes, I think it's clear in the first part of Section 11 that the parties were trying to do something akin to contributory negligence. W.C. English was only indemnified to the extent that they were fault-free. But they're doing something completely different in the second part of that paragraph.
I think you say in your brief, if I'm remembering right, that if we thought it were ambiguous, then it would be a question for the jury. But if we thought it were ambiguous, isn't there also a canon that then we should construe it against the drafter?
Well, it's unclear here who the drafter
would be. That's what I was going to ask you. Why is that?
Here, the interlineations, and I believe we cite to the specific record page, mm-hmm. were made by, I believe, counsel for RK&K.
So why aren't they the drafter of the language that's ambiguous?
You could certainly reach that conclusion.
What's the argument that they're not?
I think there's a little ambiguity because the contract itself came from
okay.
us, but the actual language, to the extent that was adopted, was language, as I understand the record, that was proposed by RK&K.
Okay.
Ambiguous, I will just point out, there are three other of your sister courts who have also considered similar language, talking about the extent of negligence. They have all concluded that in those three cases, the language was ambiguous and that it was appropriate to go to a jury in that situation.
Well, it seemed that it would have been RK&K because there are no changes for CDM, just your boilerplate.
That's correct. If there aren't any further questions on RK&K, I'd like to take the opportunity to talk briefly about CDM Smith. As I said before, this is more of a classic summary judgment problem. And here, I think it's important to focus on the standard before this court. I certainly don't expect this court to blame CDM Smith for 100% of the problem that occurred. I'm not even sure what percentage the court will assign. But the question before this court, and the question that should have been before the trial court, was any reasonable juror who takes every inference and takes every fact in W.C. English's favor, can they assign any portion of the blame, regardless of how small, on CDM Smith? If you look at the facts in this case, I think the answer, I'll certainly argue to a jury, is that you can assign at least some of that fault to CDM Smith. And here's what we know. We know that CDM Smith specifically stopped W.C. English, who was correctly building the bridge, and told them to do it the wrong way. That fact alone should be dispositive. But we've got other facts in the records. We know that on the 21st of April, 3 days before the concrete was locked in place, at least as my opponents tell the story, that the bridge inspector for DCDM Smith knew that there was a nonconformity. But rather than raise his hand, raise a flag, and say, guys, we need to redo this entire work again, he simply notes that we should recheck the spacing. He doesn't say anything's wrong. He doesn't say it's noncompliant. He simply states, recheck the spacing.
I have a question about this. It wasn't clear to me that it was CDM's job to say what conformed and what didn't. I thought that was what RK and K did, that CDM sort of measured it and said, here's what it looks like, and then it was up to RK and K to figure out whether or not that conformed to the specifications. Is that not right?
I disagree with that.
Okay.
Certainly their primary job is as measurements.
Mm-hmm.
But they have an additional job, and it's laid out in part 4 of that QA/QC plan of what they need to do when their measurements reveal that there's a nonconformity. So they have their own independent responsibilities, and they've got their own independent...
How do they even know? I thought RK and K were the people who sort of had... I mean, I have a very rudimentary understanding, but I'm sort of picturing they're the ones with the expertise and the drawings, and so CDM goes to them and says, this thing is 3 inches big. That's all we know. And then RK and K figures out, well, does the plan call for 3 inches, or is the plan supposed to have something bigger? And so they report up through RK and K.
They do report up through, but they've got their own independent obligations to evaluate whether it's compliant or non-compliant. And I point the court actually...
Are those three levels, levels 1, 2, and 3, imposed on CDM Smith?
I would say no, Your Honor. Those in part 3 of the plan, that's the QA section, those are really focused primarily RK and K. It's part 4 that's drafted by CDM Smith that's supposed to
and
lay
what's
out
the duty if they see non-compliance, they find the measurements out, what is their duty under the documents?
Their first duty is to try to notify the people on the ground and get it fixed immediately. Failing that, they need to report a non-conformity to WC English's construction manager and file a non-conformity report if it's not being fixed.
Did they do that?
They did not. And that's why we're here. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'm happy to rest on my briefs.
Thank you. Mr. Bayless?
May it please the court, my name is Bill Bayless, and I'm here with my partners, Brendan O'Toole and Joseph Pope, on behalf of RK&K. RK&K was the QA inspector on this job. This is a bridge job, a complicated bridge job. These are very sophisticated parties to a 70-some page contract. And when you start with the position that these are sophisticated parties negotiating the contract, and Judge Hollander mentioned about a boilerplate contract that wasn't changed, RK&K was presented with a contract that was not acceptable to them. RK&K would not accept the allocation of risk as a QA inspector and be responsible and a guarantor of the work of English. English was the general contractor. It was English's job to perform pursuant to the terms and conditions of the contract and to deliver pursuant to the plans and drawings. So when you start from the beginning, when this contract was entered into, they, like CDM Smith, are presented with this 70-some page document, and they made changes. They carefully reviewed and made a conscious decision, we will not accept the contract as presented. So what did they do?
Who are you referring to as they? Your client?
What did RK&K do? Right.
Oh, okay.
Right. So
that's
I'm
what
sorry.
I thought.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so, you agree that these changes were interposed by RK&K?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
The boilerplate was done, and I will also point out, not only were they made by RK&K, every one of them was accepted by
Well, do you, just to see if we can cut through a little bit and get agreement, do you suggest then that because this was a negotiated contract between two parties, each of which contributed provisions, we don't apply the canon that it's strictly construed against one party or the other?
My position, Judge, to answer to that is I understand what the question that was asked earlier, that it would be construed against the drafter of the contract. Each side did, in fact, put in their
That canon applies generally when a contract is designed by one side and presented to the other side, and the other side signs. But here, as you point out, there was negotiation. There was an unwillingness to accept the contract as originally written, and there were changes made, which is an indication that this is more bilateral in its negotiations, and therefore the canon wouldn't apply.
Absolutely. And, okay. and not only absolutely, what's interesting is to go back to the time the contract was drafted, and the roles of the respective parties being involved. When they made the changes, English accepted every single one of the changes. There's no further negotiations, and signed the contract.
And well, those changes, you know, just as a matter of aside, it gets back on my thesis that it is terribly confusing in the law to discuss negligence duties in connection with the performance of a contract. Negligence duties do exist on the site. People who are negligent have responsibilities. They carry insurance for it and so forth. Most insurance companies won't ensure the actual performance of the contract. And yet the clauses, as you started out, were negligence in one paragraph and performance in the other. But the second paragraph of paragraph 11 starts out addressing performance deficiencies and assessment of performance, but yet the change your client made was to the extent directly caused by negligence of subcontractor. That really should have been said by the non-performance of subcontractor. So you're mixing negligence concepts with non-performance concepts, and I must say, I think if you were really going to construe these contracts literally, neither party would be very happy.
Well, and this is a contract case. It's not a negligence case. And when you,
I understand it is.
So
yes.
In response to what you just said about by using the words negligence as to performance.
Well, I'm looking at the change written by your client.
I understand what you're talking about, and I'll deal with that out of the context of my argument.
Well, I'm not sure you can deal with it. In other words, it says it imposes a non-performance liability, and then you add to the extent directly caused by the negligence of some contractor. So the question is, to the extent caused by the negligence, we're talking about non-performance caused by the negligence. Now, that's a strange concept. I think it looks to me, if I were reading it casually, it looks to me like that's intended to apportion non-performance between the parties to the extent that they're responsible for the non-performance.
But if you look at the entire language in there, and
well, I did. That's what I seemed to glean from that.
Right. But, well, if you see what they drafted, and I think it's important, and I think it was pointed out by Judge Moon as well when he analyzed the issue that you're talking about in that particular provision, if you look at that language, it says to the extent directly caused by the negligence of subcontractor, that's RK&K. The word directly was used there.
Yeah, but that's approximate cause notion for negligence. That's a strange concept too, to apply when you're talking about non-performance. Non-performance is a failure to conform to the contract.
Right.
They called for 10-inch beams and I put in 8-inch beams. That's non-performance. Now, whether that's caused by negligence or not, the standard in the law is to pay the damages for the non-performance. And I've assumed that these clauses, even as amended by your client, was intended so that you wouldn't be a guarantor of all deficiencies of performance, but that each party would bear its responsibility in that regard. And the district judge seemed to read it that way in one provision, but then said there's another provision that seemed to be in tension with it, and then it started applying canons and resolving those tensions, and that gets into dangerous territory. I mean, it's now it's finding an ambiguity and trying to resolve the ambiguity itself.
And he dealt with that on pages.
I know he did. He spent a lot of time on that.
And there are really three
maybe
provisions.
Maybe the jury should have done that.
Well, from a contractual context, if you look at all three of the provisions, you see what the intent of the parties was.
Except if you read it carefully, the provisions address different circumstances. And what your briefs, both you and the other side, blur is the notion of negligence and the notion of non-performance. And in doing so, you then denude these provisions of their intent, original purpose. Even the changes tend to confuse it, I think. And I must say, I found this all pretty messy.
Well, again, when you use the word negligence, and they use the word negligence yeah. there, and if you fail to conform, you're not following the standard. You are negligent when you do what you did. In this
but the
case,
law does not impose a duty of negligence in failing to perform as specified or as agreed. The law imposes contract damages and assesses liability based on that basis. There's a whole doctrine involving negligence, and we have contributory negligence, comparative negligence, we have a duty of safety, duty of tort duty, and everybody at the job site has tort responsibilities. They can be negligent. The crane can fall and injure people or can damage the bridge. Those are negligence issues. The issues in this case, as I understand it, are singly and solely non-performance.
And what Judge Moon did, and he didn't create a tort standard here. If you read the language, what he did in this case, and applying the language in the contract.
Well, he imposed, he said there's a contributory negligence standard. He resolved these tensions in the contract and says the contract creates a contributory negligence thing, and since English was negligent, there can be no recovery. Does that make sense?
Well, I think what he did was use the contributory negligence and the comparative negligence as an analogy to what was intended.
They could have, but that isn't what led to. What did he conclude after he said this is a contributory negligence provisions? The contract imposed contributory negligence regime. What did he then conclude?
He concluded
that English was responsible, and he did not assess whether you guys were responsible at all because it was irrelevant.
That's exactly what he did, when he did it, RK&K would not be liable if damages were caused by English unless RK&K directly or proximately caused the injury. And so he did deal with that, and he did not conclude that RK&K directly or approximately.
Well, don't you think that's an error of law when you impose a negligence standard of contributory negligence? Forget whether he's right about the contributory negligence. In other words, all or nothing. The idea of precluding responsibility based on one party's negligence is purely a tort concept. It's not a contract concept. And the question is, in this case, did the parties guarantee, in other words, did English bear all the responsibility for non-performance when non-performance could be attributable to one of two contractors or both, or partially?
How would the
contract, if you considered a contract, how would it assess breaches of responsibilities by all three?
And I think what Judge Moon did when he made the decision that he did was look at all three of the provisions and not just a half of a sentence by itself, and he harmonized that, as we've said in our brief.
He did a lot of harmonizing, no question about it. But my question then is, if he's to read this whole contract between contractor and subcontractors, basically, if English has any responsibility for some of the non-performance, then that frees up all the contractors from any defalcations. I just don't believe the contract says that.
Well, in response to that one specific point that you made, if you look at what they did, they struck the word sole negligence out of English's responsibility. They struck it. These parties didn't have to agree to that. These parties agreed. That is a single.
See, but the provisions dealing with negligence are not dealing with defalcations. Negligence on the job is understood. Every contractor knows what, and you have to provide insurance for the negligence, and the provisions are all thought out. They've been negotiated. In my judgment, the attorneys who got involved in negotiating this didn't understand the difference between non-performance and negligence on a job, and they are two different fields of liability. And if you're arguing that there is a contributory negligence type of scheme, then you're suggesting that if English failed to do part of its duty in the performance, and if the two subcontractors also failed substantially to do what they were supposed to do, English has to bear the whole responsibility. That's the conclusion that your argument leads to.
Well, and my argument is that those words were drafted so that we did not become the guarantor of their performance.
Of course not, but how about your own performance? What if you and C.D. Smith failed to do certain things when they discovered the improper construction? They had responsibilities, the quality control agreements imposed responsibilities, there were reporting requirements, there were recording requirements, and VDOC had to know, VDOT had to know something along this line on something this serious. Now, none of those reports were generated. And the question is, it's not solely English's problem. You guys were hired to do something.
Oh, there's no question we were hired
except
to do something.
If you're saying that if English had a little bit of non-performance, they could have solved the whole thing, then you guys are off the hook, even though you guys didn't breach your contracts.
Well, in this case, English didn't have a little bit of, they had a lot of responsibility.
Sure, let them have a lot of responsibility, but you have a responsibility. If English says, perform this way, your client has to say, that's not in accordance with the specs, and they say, do it anyway, then you have to report it to the construction manager and the Virginia Department of Transportation. Well, that's under the agreement.
Well, and under the agreement,
and you didn't do it.
Well, in this particular factual situation, you've got a 3/4-inch cover issue is what you have. And what happened here is, and you have to look at Mr. Plott's affidavit, and that's what Judge Moon looked at for certain, and that is that they failed to process the RFI, and their own people testified unequivocally that they expected them to process it, thought they had processed it, thought it had been approved. And that's what this contract is drafted to protect against, is where English, in this particular case...
Except the contract imposes specific duties on your client.
Yes, sir.
In connection with non-conformance. And your conformance isn't determined by what English tells you. Your conformance is determined by the specs. And if you find something out of spec, you have duties. And those duties clearly were not followed. Now, English could be wrong in telling you to do it. And they bear a responsibility, too. They say, do it. As a matter of fact, there's some dialogue I read in one of the transcripts where the guy said, go ahead and do it. You're not running the job or something like that. And it's mixed testimony, incidentally, on all this. Who's responsible? Who said to go it? I mean, I don't think there's any clear result. But the specs were not followed. Everybody seems to agree. It was known before the pour that the specs weren't being followed. And the question is, who had to do something? And the contract imposes duties on all three of you.
And in this case, the ultimate duty is imposed on the general contractor to process that RFI, which they failed to do.
That's not the ultimate duty. The ultimate duty for you is to report it to the contract manager in writing. And I think you have a duty to go to the Virginia Department of Transportation.
Our contract is only with English in this case.
Don't you have a reporting duty to a Virginia Department?
No, our contract is to
I know who
that
the contract's
English.
With, but do you have a duty to report a failure a gross failure of following the specs to the Virginia Department of Transportation?
I don't know where in the contract. I can't answer that question. I don't know.
It's not in the quality control agreement?
It would be we're the quality assurance, the QA.
Quality assurance.
And there's an overall agreement. But
well, let me ask you this. Did you, in any circumstance, your client have a responsibility to report to Virginia Department of Transportation with respect to gross nonconformance with specs?
I cannot point to the contract where we did.
Okay,
but
fair
to
enough.
Answer your question.
You at least had a duty to report it to the construction manager.
Absolutely.
In writing.
And in this case, everyone proceeded, and all you have to do is look at the record, everyone proceeded thinking that everyone was in conformance.
But they may have all agreed. They may have all said this and that. But your duty was independent of what English is telling you. Your duty was contractual. And if it's a non-spec situation and you know it, and you say to English, foreman of the supervisors, and he says, that's fine, do it. We've done this before. Go ahead and do it. And you say, but it's not in conformity with the spec. And even days before the pour, at least C.D. Smith knew it wasn't in conformity with the spec, but no one generated the written document to the construction manager saying it's not in conformance with the spec.
And I don't disagree with any of that, Jeff, yeah. But I'll end this conversation.
Yeah.
And in my argument at this point by simply saying, when this contract was drafted, it was drafted in a manner in which RK&K was not willing to accept the ultimate responsibility of performance by English and become its guarantor, and that's why this language was drafted in there.
I understand that, and that's fair enough, but that doesn't relieve you of your contractual duties that you undertook to do on the job. You're not going to have responsibility ultimately for the work, but you will have responsibility for the consequences of failing to do what you undertook to do, which was, if you have a disagreement about whether the specs are being followed, you have to notify in writing the construction manager. And so, that wasn't done.
I don't disagree as far as that wasn't done, but in this particular case, it's a contract case, just like you said.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, Judge Moon accepted the contractual modifications made by RK&K, the non-willingness to accept the ultimate responsibility, and concluded that if RK&K would not be liable if damages were caused by English unless RK&K directly or approximately caused it. And he followed the contract language, and that's why he granted summary judgment.
Well, that's right. He said English caused it.
Yes, sir.
And he never assessed what your responsibility was and what your contribution was and whether that cause could have been eliminated had you followed your duty.
No, I think...
And he didn't do that because he applied a doctrine of contributory negligence in a contract case.
Well, he analogized this to contributory negligence.
Except that he
correct.
Applied the doctrine that way, too. He relieved you of contractual responsibility.
And that's what he said when he made that decision.
I know.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. All right. You've got... do you have time back? All right, Mr. Smith.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jason Smith on behalf of C.D.M. Smith. I also have with me my colleague, Anthony Laca, who's also on briefs. I agree with the Court. I've sat here and listened to the argument, and Judge Niemeyer, I think you've hit many of the salient points on the head. This is a breach of contract action, and the District Court ruled that C.D.M. Smith, there was no genuine dispute of material fact. We satisfied all of our contractual obligations. And the undisputed evidence below is...
Let me ask you, just going to that, what were the responsibilities of your client if it knew of a failure to follow spec and believed that specs were not being followed in the construction of the bridge?
And I want to address that. And that's...
I just want to know the contractual duty imposed on your client for that.
The contractual obligations with respect to quality assurance and quality control on this project are set forth in what's called the QSC.
I know, but you're not answering my question. I want to say just C.D.M. Smith, if it knows that specs are not being followed, what do you understand the contract to impose, what duties to impose on C.D.M. Smith specifically?
And the reason why I was going to the QAQC plan is what we had to do contractually depended upon the level of the nonconformity.
Make the level level three.
If it was a level three nonconformity,
right.
Which there is no evidence in the record to
make
suggest
that it is.
Make it
a level three. We can go hypothetical this time. I just want to know what your duty was.
Sure. If it was a level three nonconformity, we had an obligation to notify the quality assurance manager, who at the time of this pour was Richard Clark of RK&K, a professional engineer, and we had an obligation to notify WC English.
Both English or some particular person?
WC English.
You didn't have a duty to notify the construction manager?
There is conflicting language in the contract. The construction manager at the time is ambiguous. There is no evidence in the record to suggest exactly who that individual is.
I'm not asking that. I'm asking for the contractual duty. Let's stick just with the contract. Was there any title specified as to who you had to notify at English?
And again, Your Honor, it depends on how and which part of the contract you're reading. There's a portion of the contract that says it has to go to the design build management, and there's a portion of the contract that says construction manager.
All right. So now, if you don't perform on both, you say there's a tension between the two?
Correct.
One way to comply is to notify both, right?
Well, that would be one way to comply if it were a level 3 non-compliant.
That's my hypothetical.
And I understand.
Yeah. Okay. And that had to be in writing, right?
It eventually had to be reduced to an NCR, a non-conformance report, which would then get transmitted to English.
And, all right. You know. All right. So those were the duties your client had. And I did read testimony about your client took the position that there was non-compliance in the very short time before the pour, and he persisted in that. He knew it at the time. And there's also no evidence that he notified either of those people in writing. And there, so we have a situation now where the district court relieved you of that responsibility because it found English was at fault.
Well, I don't necessarily agree that that was the district court's conclusion. I agree
the
that
the district court said it was a level 2 violation, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. The district court agreed that it was a level 2 nonconformity, and so the obligation.
And wasn't there a dispute on that?
Well, that's unclear in the record. I think.
Well, it's pretty clear. The English said in its papers it was a level 3. In the argument that was taking place, you were arguing, or your colleague was arguing, it was a level 1 or 2.
Correct.
And English then took the position that it's at least a level 2 and started arguing the level 2. But its paper, its formal position in its papers was a level 3.
Well, I
but
think.
But regardless of what people were arguing, everybody was arguing whether it's 1, 2, or 3, the consequences were different for those levels, right?
That is correct.
And
that
so the question is, what gets it to a level 3? What criteria?
It's the nature of the defect and whether or not English has agreed to make corrections is what would get you to a level 3 nonconformity.
All right, we know English didn't agree to make corrections according to your man who said it was still out of conformity. So
that's not exactly accurate. What the transcripts and the evidence, and it's undisputed below, say is that our on-site inspector informed RK&K and English of concerns that at that point in time it was RK&K and English is responsible.
And he didn't even make a note of it. He didn't write it to anybody. He didn't go above these people. He just sort of went ahead and I don't know what he did. I read his testimony.
Well, the testimony is, and there's no dispute as to it, is that once RK&K and English met to determine how they were going to address the issues that had been raised, they made a decision on whether or not they conformed or not conformed, which we were not a party to. Again, we're the lowest level inspector out at the project. And made the decision to proceed and were informed that at that point it was in conformance with what was required. And again,
well, how could you do that when your client testified it was not? Even as they poured, he knew it was not.
Well, there was some discussion in the testimony about tolerance levels. There was also an ability in the testimony that the issue has to do with the screed level and the rideability of the highway. There was argument between RK&K and English as to whether or not that the tolerances were allowed to be higher due to rideability issues and screed distance in the steel to allow this thing to be level so that appropriate travel passage could take place. And those arguments took place between RK&K and English.
I know they took place before, but the question is, you had an independent contractual duty to do something when you see something that you didn't agree with.
We did.
And I couldn't find where you complied with a level 3 if that was the right level. And I think that's a disputed question. The question is, shouldn't the jury decide whether it's a level 2 or 3?
Well, no, I don't agree. I don't think it is a level 3 nonconformity. I don't think there's evidence to suggest that there is.
Tell me why.
For a couple of reasons. One, the issue with the level 3 nonconformity has to do with the severity and whether or not it can be corrected. It could have been corrected. And English and RK&K met to discuss how they were going to proceed with correcting that work. Level 3 nonconformities are something that require a substantial amount of effort to correct and require VDOT to be
That's exactly what they argued. They argued it would be too expensive and too delayed time. They'd have to have a crane in there. They'd probably have to change those, what do you call those runners, those spacers?
The slab runners.
Slab runners. They'd either have to change those or make some kind of an adjustment on those. They needed to achieve, what, 2 3/4 inches at the top.
Well, it depends on the dimensions of the rebar, and it's the clearance issue.
That's what I said, 2 3/4 inches of concrete above the rebar.
Right, but there are other ways to get to that clearance level without actually replacing the slab.
But the question is, that's a pretty significant thing.
Yeah, but
they had to rebuild the whole bridge.
Well, no, that's not. They were correcting the overall clearance and the overall distance between the top of the mat and what was going to ultimately be the top of the roadway on the 24th prior to the pour. Those where there's a document in the record, it's the dry run report, where in writing, our inspector identified discrepancies and places where the deck did not
perform. He circled two of them.
Yeah.
I remember.
And provided them
that
to RK&K and provided them to English.
But he never made a report of nonconformance.
But we didn't need to provide a report of nonconformance where English and RK&K met and decided that it was in conformance and they were going to proceed. Even if we had an obligation to provide an NCR, it never would have stopped this pour from taking place. NCRs weren't required to be produced until 24 hours after the nonconformance was identified. That's in Section 4 of the QAQC plan. So the idea that this would have somehow stopped anything from proceeding when RK&K and English had made the decision to proceed.
Diminish your role. It seems to me you had an important role in this bridge, and you diminish it down to, you basically say it was KKR or English, and you guys were sort of
sitting
on the side watching and making notes and calling into the newspapers or what. I don't know what your role was.
I don't know about calling to the newspapers, Your Honor. But I do diminish our role, and I diminish it for this reason. Our job was to go out and take measurements and to identify any potential issues where there were deviations from the written specifications or the drawings. That
was
our role.
Deviation, and not whether the parties agreed. If the parties agreed to a deviation that was not shown in the specs, you have a duty.
If the parties agreed to a deviation.
If English and RRK agreed on the site, go ahead, this is fine, we've agreed to this, and it's out of conformity with the specs, you have a contractual duty to take some action.
Well, I agree we have a contractual duty. We have a contractual duty to identify the issue to the appropriate personnel, which we did. The difference is, I believe the court is conflating us with RK&K. All we could do was raise the issue to the appropriate people. We did not have authority to do anything further.
That's what I started out in my questioning with you. We tried to identify what your contractual duties were. And you said on a serious defalcation, you had to report to the construction manager or the design team.
Right.
And you didn't know which.
No, I said both. Well, it could be one, or it depends on which part of the contract.
But we agree that neither of those got that report.
Right, if it was a level 3.
Right,
But let me be clear. Once we identified those issues, even if we had, and again, Dylan Frazier ultimately, who was told by us about these issues and was on site at this time and was the construction manager at some point in time, and it's unclear when, and was responsible for the bridge, knew about these issues and was told by CDM Smith specifically about the issues with the clearance. The other point I would like to make is that when we told RK&K, and English's position is that the inspector should have done something more than they did, the only entity that at that point in time could have done something more was RK&K, who had authority contractually to stop the work.
Well, the district court relieved them of responsibility, too.
Well, I'm not taking a position on whether or not RK&K
should
be relieved.
Well, it does affect you both, because that's the way the court construed the whole contract. In other words, your performance wasn't subject to a lot of scrutiny because of the understanding of the contract and the indemnity provisions, which I don't know how to read them fully. I'd like to go to a monastery and read them for a week.
That sounds like a relaxing venture. But the district court's primary ruling with respect to us was that there was no genuine dispute that we did not material breach any term in our contract. And there's been no allegation of error with respect to Article 11 in our subcontract. And frankly, we don't have the same ambiguity language.
Right.
So I don't know that applies to us. The driving force in the district court's decision is we complied with all of our contractual obligations. And we contend that we did, and there's no genuine material dispute.
What is the contractual duty if it was a level two?
If it was a level two, we had an obligation to inform the on-site foreman and RK&K and record it in our daily work report.
When you say RK&K, did it have the name of an official?
It did. Well, the quality assurance manager, who at the time was Richard Clark.
And did that have to be in writing, or could that be oral?
We believe it could be an oral communication.
It didn't say whether it was in writing.
And that's, in fact, the evidence from below is that's, in fact, how the parties were proceeding with respect to this.
Yeah.
If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer it. I realize I'm over my time, but I would encourage the court. We briefed many of these issues, and I know Judge Neymar has already read them, but many of these issues were addressed below and briefed extensively, and I believe there's adequate information in the briefs.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Smith. All right, Mr. Paul.
Our request to this court is simple. Reverse the trial court and let these issues go to a jury to decide how to allocate the respective blame between the parties.
What is your response to CDM Smith's argument that this is clearly a level two violation and that they complied and there was no dispute of fact about that?
I've got several responses to that, Your Honor. The first one I'll start with is this whole level structure deals with the QA plan, not the QC plan. It's part four of this document that relates the duties that CDM Smith has. It's part three that relates to the duties that RK&K has. So I encourage the court to actually look
at. Tell me what CDM Smith had a duty to do.
Sure. And I'd point you to.
Contractually.
I'd point you to page 1714 in the record, which is part four, which is the QC plan, subsection paragraph 4.9, non-compliant work corrective action. It says the QCM will immediately notify the construction manager if materials or workmanship do not comply with the specifications. Any quality issues or deficiencies will be documented in the daily diary sheets as well as the appropriate checklist. That was not done in this case. It continues on to say, none of that was done.
So you're saying there was no oral report?
But not to the construction manager.
That didn't require a written report.
Well,
the diary.
The diary,
the diary is a written report.
Wasn't there one diary?
I was asking which one. I'm sorry.
No. I thought there was, like, on April 21st, a diary entry.
There's a short note by the inspector not pointing out a deficiency in this area, but saying to recheck generally the spacing.
So there was a diary sheet, but you think it was inadequate.
But not that identifies an issue or deficiency. I mean, if the inspector believed that it was wrong, he had an obligation to say in writing on the 21st, this is wrong. You are not in conformity with the specification. And he didn't.
Okay. So I thought your argument was going to be he had to do it again on the 24th.
He certainly did. He had obligations at both places.
But you think he, okay.
I don't think he met his obligations on the 21st either.
Okay.
And I encourage the court to continue reading section 4.9. If the issues or deficiencies cannot be resolved, and everybody agrees that CDM Smith didn't think the issues were resolved by April 24th, then they've got the obligation that the inspector will advise the quality assurance manager and initiate a non-conformance report. That was not done in this case. So they didn't meet the contractual responsibilities. I want to lay the background. You've got a large construction project.
Let me just go back to this level 1, 2, and 3. You say that's in part 3?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that applies only to KKR?
Primarily to RK&K.
RK&K, excuse me.
That document is focused on the obligations of RK&K.
Doesn't it also say things about what CDM Smith has to do?
It does. I mean, the right. Two sections are intended to connect to one another, but part 4 is the part that CDM Smith prepares laying out their obligations. Part 3 is what RK&K prepares laying out their obligations, and they're intended to marry up together. But the primary document regarding what CDM Smith is supposed to do is part 4.
Okay, except that, but we agree, part 3 also says a bunch about what CDM Smith is supposed to do.
It does.
And the district court thought it was marrying them up by sort of coming up with this analysis that the more specific, and part 3 is more specific, governs as to step 1 or level 1 and level 2, and on level 3, there's no inconsistency.
I agree that's what the trial court did. I don't know that was proper. We still think the jury should have been the one making those decisions. But I want to go back, Judge Niemeyer, and address The second reason, I think you should just ignore these levels. And that's because in Part 3, the levels specifically assume that we've identified a problem that is actually being resolved. In fact, if you look at the specific language on page 2403 of the record that lays out the levels, all of them are operating under the assumption of we've identified a problem, we're in the process of fixing that problem. On April 24th, that's not what was happening. CDM Smith knew that there was a nonconformity that wasn't getting fixed. That takes it sort of outside that level structure and puts us directly into paragraph 4.9 when they know there's a problem that, quote, cannot be resolved.
So if all of part three, if all of the part three levels assume a problem is being corrected, does that mean that RK and K has no obligations if English just says we're not fixing it? So if there is a problem that is not being corrected, and this is the only part that governs RK and K's obligations with respect to a nonconformity, does that mean they have no obligations if it's not being fixed?
I wouldn't say that was the only part of the whole plan that addresses RK and K's obligations. They've got other, there are other parts of that plan that talk about the need to inform VDOT and the need to report these other issues. So, but the structure that's put in place there is a structure to address things that everybody believes is being resolved. It's differentiating what you do when you can fix it that day, when you can fix it the next day.
Can you just tell me where the part is about what RK and K is supposed to do if it's not being fixed?
I can't point you to that right now on the record, Judge. I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right, anything else?
No, I just ask that you allow us to go back to the jury and have the jury decide.
All right, we'll come down to Greek Council and proceed on to the last case.